Welcome to Shetland with Laurie, a podcast dedicated to Shetland, the place and the people, with me, Laurie Goodland, a writer and tour guide based at 60 degrees north. The Shetland with Laurie podcast is for people who have visited Shetland, or who would like to visit, or for those who would just like to know a little bit more about life here. So welcome, I'm so glad you're here. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Shetland with Laurie podcast. Today on the show, I'm very excited to have Shetlander Bea Leask, who you may know from her Instagram at BumbleBambi, join me. Bea grew up in Shetland and now lives in Scotland, but Shetland is very much a part of how she identifies and it has shaped her life in so many ways, which we will discuss in the episode. I started following her a few years ago on Instagram and I was so inspired by her adventures in the Highlands and Islands, where she is busy ticking off all Scotland's inhabited islands and 282 Munros. So I was really excited when she agreed to come on the show and talk a bit more about her adventures, about growing up in Shetland and just about all the things that us islanders enjoy speaking about. So community and belonging, we cover it all in the show today. So let's just dive in and say hello to Bea. Okay, so welcome to the podcast, Bea. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I discovered you online and it was quite a shock because I discovered you on Instagram a few years ago and you had just thousands and thousands of followers, and then I realized that you were actually from Shetland. And I thought, well, I have no idea who this girl is. And I was delighted to actually meet you when you were home again. Was that last summer?
I think it was, yeah, it was last summer.
It's funny, I think with this year being the way it has been, then I have no idea when anything happened.
The concept of time has disappeared completely. But yeah, it was like last summer, I think it's just before summer in.
Yeah, and so you joined me and we did the evening trip into Moosa, which was brilliant.
Yes, that was amazing. That was such a good trip because I'd been to Moosa before, only recently, fairly recently actually. And but I'd obviously just done the kind of walk and out to the Broch and then back. But I didn't really know much about like the storm petrels and everything. So it was so interesting. And obviously my friend was there as well. And yeah, it was brilliant. Such a good tour.
Yeah, and it's just so amazing going in at night. It's a completely different atmosphere, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, because it's somewhere you're really kind of familiar with, obviously, in Shetland, but then to be there in the evening, I don't know, it just felt like, and I know obviously there are trips all the time, but you felt like a little bit special because you're like, oh, I'm here in the evening, I'm here at night time. It was really nice, really exciting.
I know. And for those who don't know you, could you just kind of introduce yourself and tell us a bit about you?
I always struggle with this but it always feels a bit awkward, but I don't know, I obviously always call myself a Shetlander, and I just like being outdoors. I love being outdoors and exploring Scotland and the islands, so kids, yeah. An adventurer, outdoor addict, anything like that. Basically anything outside I'm happy doing, and I obviously share my adventures and stories on Instagram, which is kind of where I got a few followers and things.
And that's really why I wanted to get you on, was because you did grow up in Shetland. And when guests come here, they always ask me about whether or not young people stay in Shetland or whether they move away. And so I wanted to get somebody on that actually grew up in the Isles here, but then did move away. So could you just tell us what it was like for you growing up in Shetland?
Well, Shetland, growing up, I mean, I've always said it's just the best upbringing. Certainly for me, it was very safe. You were kind of outdoors all the time. I've always kind of described it as a bit feral, but I think that's like in a really positive way, because you are just kind of allowed to explore. You're on the beach all the time. You're always muddy and sandy and things, and exploring old croft houses. So for me growing up, it was an adventurous upbringing. You know, we literally were outside all of the time, and you know what the weather's like in Shetland, it was just kind of expected that you're out, you know, in any kind of weather. And for me, it's just, I think as you kind of maybe grow to like your teens and maybe early 20s, it's maybe not what you want to be doing as much, but I think it's definitely the reason I've kind of came back to the outdoors. is purely because it was basically how I grew up and what I was used to. So for me, it was, yeah, a fantastic upbringing. Like, obviously I have nothing to compare it to, but I can't imagine growing up in a city when I had the upbringing that I did. Just that kind of freedom to explore and be out and be active.
And I think, I know when I, because you're based now just outside Glasgow, and is that right? Yeah. And I know that whenever you get the opportunity, then you kind of hide for the highlands and hide for the hills. And I know myself, when I was at university in a city, I sometimes felt quite hemmed in by it. And I think that that does come from having the freedom growing up on an island in somewhere like Shetland.
I mean, I think for me, like, I really miss having the sea on my doorstep, because, you know, anywhere in Shetland, you can see the sea, you can smell the sea, you know, it's there. And for me, like, I love, obviously, I think all islanders, anybody who lives by the coast, you just love the being by the sea and the, I don't know, it just, obviously, it's a lot of nostalgia for me as well. But I definitely, being in a city, you know, there are lovely kind of green spaces and things, but there's not that same kind of wildness, I suppose. You know, you could out your front door and, like, within a couple of minutes, you know, you're somewhere really gorgeous and quite remote, and, you know, it might not always be like spectacular scenery, but you're on the shore of the, you know, the sea. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, you do notice it is difficult, I think, being in near a city when you're used to the kind of the wilderness of Shetland, I suppose.
Yeah. And when did you leave Shetland, and I mean, do you think you'll ever move back home?
Well, it wasn't a choice that I moved. I was like my mid-teens, so it wasn't really my decision. It was like my parents, because my dad is a Shetlander and my mom is from just outside Glasgow. So I think when she got whisked up to Shetland, it was quite a culture shock for her. She left, you know, the kind of city. And obviously in the kind of, you know, when she moved up, maybe the transport wasn't as great. She didn't drive. So I think on one hand, it was quite, I think she found it quite restrictive. But on the other hand, the community spirit in Shetland and anywhere that you stay, you know, you are immediately, if you're embracing the community and you want to be a part of it, they embrace you. So my mum had, you know, fantastic memories, fantastic time up there, which was great for us. But I think she always did, I think she is a kind of city person. So my dad got the opportunity of kind of early retirement, and he took that, and then we all moved. But it wasn't my choice. I would have definitely stayed, because I was still kind of at that age where I was quite happy where I was. Who knows when I got older what, you know, how it would have worked out. But yeah, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't devastated to be leaving. I was quite excited. You know, you're young, you're quite, you know, you're happy for new opportunities and things. But yeah, I do wish I'd stayed a little bit longer, because, you know, it's home. You know, you never want to leave home, do you?
No, I know. And it must be difficult with, like, without the same kind of family ties as well. If your family are moving, then you've not got that same reason, I suppose. But you've still got quite a lot of your family that still live here, so you can come back and visit them.
Yeah, exactly. So very fortunate, you know, have family in Bow and in Walsa as well. So we do get up to visit, you know, as often as we can. And obviously, as much as they're not maybe blood relatives, but obviously where I grew up, it's, you know, it's so close-knit, you know, and obviously if anything happens, unfortunately, if there's funerals and things, you're always home and you kind of get to see everybody. But yeah, it's been a wee bit more difficult this year, obviously, but it's always, you know, any kind of reason to go home, I'm always glad to go back. But yeah, I do kind of, if my dad lived there, it'd probably make it a lot easier, but oh well.
Do you think it's important for young people to spend some time away from Shetland if you've grown up here? Because I know for me, I definitely appreciate Shetland more, having lived on the mainland for a few years. And I think when I living away made me see, I suppose, the privilege that we have living here. And so when I came home, I saw it in a slightly different light than before.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, because, you know, I think it's very easy when you're maybe, not so much when you're a kid, you kind of, you know, you're in awe of everything, but maybe when you get a little bit older, you feel like maybe it's not really for you, the kind of nightlife maybe isn't what you would want and all these kind of things. So I do understand kind of people want to move away, and I know a lot of like ones go to uni and stuff, and then they go, you know, a lot of ones do go home, obviously. I think it definitely does like make you appreciate, I don't know if it's like an age thing or if it's from being away or a combination, but you definitely appreciate that you come back and you think, you realize how lucky you are. And even you're away and you tell people you're from Shetland, there's always a reaction. There's always like, oh my goodness, Shetland, you know, they're quite they're quite intrigued by it, and they're usually like, they maybe know somebody from Shetland, so they'll obviously ask if you know them. And then there's some people that are like, oh, I've never met anybody from Shetland, what's that like? And you know, I think you realize from other people's reactions how special a place it is, you know. And a lot of people are like, oh my goodness, like I'm so desperate to go there, what's it like, you're so lucky. So I think, as with anything, when you're away from it, you probably do kind of appreciate it a wee bit more and realize how lucky you are to have kind of grown up there and be from there.
Yeah, and I think that more and more people are kind of aware of Shetland, especially after like the Shetland TV show and things, and so it's kind of on more people's radar. So when you say that you're from Shetland, people today kind of instantly know geographically where it is and have an idea of what it might be like. But also there is some like thriving industries here, like the oil industry, the fishing industry, and so it is the case that loads of people that you meet when you're on the mainland or whatever know somebody that works in Shetland in the oil or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, you know, the Shetland TV series has been great for it. You know, it's you no longer seem to get as many people when you tell them you're from Shetland. I used to get a lot of people saying, oh, I have family in Stornoway, or I know people in Stornoway. I'd be like, oh, that's really nice, but it's nowhere near me. So it's quite nice now.
Or do you have electricity there?
Yes. Ah,
I got that so much at uni.
Yes, I was the same. That, and like, oh, TV, that must be really exciting. Like the constant jokes, which are like maybe funny the first few times, but it is quite nice because, like you say, it's kind of people are aware more aware of where Shetland is geographically and a bit more of an understanding of what it's like. So it is really nice. And, you know, like you say, with the oil industry, there are a lot of people, you know, certainly in the Central Belt, that have either worked up there or somebody they knew worked up there. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's definitely on the map now and not in a little box in the corner, I suppose.
Yeah. And that was actually a campaign a couple of years ago, was to get Shetland out of the box. It used to kind of sit out in the Murray Firth somewhere.
I know, it's so frustrating because you're like, that's not where it is. You kind of want to see how remote it really is, and you're like, it's not there, it's really not.
Yeah. Now, you are quite a successful blogger, and you have a really popular Instagram site, and I just love following you and watching your stories. And I suppose it's grown over the years and just taken off to levels that you probably never imagined. But what kind of opportunities has this given you, and how does it kind of shape your life today?
It's really interesting, actually, because I have to say, like, I suppose when I started Instagram, it wasn't really what it is now. They're a lot more kind of savvy of the possibilities of Instagram and things, whereas I obviously just set up my account with no real kind of idea or agenda, hence the ridiculous name. I might have used a slightly better name if I'd known.
For anybody listening, your Instagram name is @BumbleBambi.
Yeah, that's it's really, it's like two nicknames I had, and I thought, oh, that'll be a cute name, and it has no relevance to anything I do. But
it's really memorable, though. It's easy to remember.
I hope so. Yeah, it's quite, I do like it. I feel like it's kind of what I'm known as now, so I kind of have to stick with it. But it's gave me some amazing opportunities, because like when I set up my account, it was just like a little kind of photo diary for me, and then I just decided, like, my kind of tagline was like to visit every island, bag every Munro, and kind of travel everywhere in Scotland. And you know, that's what it initially started out with, and I think people quite like the theme. I think they quite like going, right, well, we know we're going to get Scotland on this account, and that's all we're going to get. So and then Instagram suggested me, which, you know, my followers went kind of from just over 1,000 pretty much overnight to crazy numbers. That was, you know, fantastic for me, but really, again, still quite early days, didn't really know what to do with it. But I have been very fortunate. I think, you know, I've worked with a lot of companies and things, and they've approached me, and I think it's because it's quite genuine. You know, it's not, I'm not doing anything for anything. It's a genuine love of the outdoors or exploring Scotland. And I like to think that comes across, and you know, people have been happy to work with me. And some of the things, you know, the things that I've done, probably it's kind of, I suppose, the chicken and egg thing. Is it like, have I done them as a result of Instagram, or would I have done them anyways? You know, it's that kind of scenario. But I'm very fortunate. I mean, yeah, I do look at a lot of the things I've kind of done and companies I've worked with, and I think, yeah, that wouldn't have happened had it not been for, not necessarily just Instagram, but the people I've met through social media who have pushed forward for things, or, you know, and it's really lovely, you know, been very, very fortunate.
Yeah, I think it's really good for connecting people, because like I said, I didn't know you when I was growing up in Shetland, and it was through Instagram that I found you. And I followed you because I liked the content that you had, and I enjoyed that kind of going around Scotland with you. And then I'd been following you for a little while before I actually realised that you were from Shetland originally, and that was a real penny drop moment.
Well, I know, that's how I need to put my surname and everything, so then people know she must have a Shetland connection.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Lise gets a real Shetland name. Yeah. And so how many islands have you done then?
Do you know, I was actually trying to work this out the other day. It's probably, if you look at how many islands there are in Scotland, there's actually hundreds, but I think I'm on like 60-something, 63, 64, and that's just inhabited ones.
That's amazing.
I know. Do you know, it's kind of weird, because I always think, but do you know what's quite frightening? I haven't even done all the islands in Shetland, which is terrible.
What ones are you missing?
Well, God, still quite a few. Fula, Fair Isle, Papastour. I'm trying to think where else. I've done, obviously, Bressa, Nos, Walza, obviously. Walza's a great island, just my wee cousins are there. they live in Walza, so everybody from Walza knows Walza's like the best island in Shetland, apparently.
Can you speak in the Walza dialect?
No, my cousins always try, because they say some really funny things, and I'm like, I've never heard that before. And obviously, a lot of people say Walza with a Q, where it sounds more like Qualza.
Qualza.
Yeah, and like, obviously, the normal kind of cup of
tea.
Yeah. But yeah, I love their little accents. But yeah, Walls is obviously the best island, so I've been there. But yeah, so a lot of the kind of outlying islands in Shetland, love to get to Fula and Fair Isle. I mean,
yeah, they are both incredible, and both so different.
Yeah.
Totally different, but both really remote islands. And so you've got that sense that they're both really remote, but completely different communities on each one. And
really.
Next time you're here, I'll come with you to one of them.
Oh, honestly, I'm desperate to. It's always trying to figure out logistics and time. And obviously the weather has such a big factor on whether you can go on things. Because last year I was hoping to get to Fair Isle.
Yeah.
But obviously they'd had the big fire, sadly, you know, with the observatory and things. But definitely on my kind of, I quite like the idea of coming up and kind of cycling around and maybe doing a bit of island hopping, but again, it's very weather dependent, so
yeah. For anybody listening that's not sure, Fair Isle and Fula are, well, Fair Isle is the most southerly island in Shetland, and Fula is the most westerly island, and they're both about 25 miles from the mainland, so you can get there by a small kind of ferry, the mailboat, or you can get a small 6-seater plane into the islands.
Yeah, definitely need to get them done. It's so on my list. It's like when you sail past Fair Isle, like you feel like you've left Lerwick ages ago.
Yeah.
And then you're sitting, and then you look out and you're like, oh my goodness, like that's us, like kind of at Fair Isle. And it just always looks amazing. So yeah, definitely need to get there. So I really do need to get the Shetland Islands done before I do any other islands, I think.
Yeah, that can be your challenge for next summer. You can come home and try and get Fula and Fair Isle ticked off.
Definitely. I think I'll put that on my list, actually.
And obviously, we're not going to deny that Shetland's the best island, obviously, in Scotland. But if you had to kind of choose some of your other favourites in Scotland, what would they be?
There's so many, you know, because they're all so different.
I think
I say it every time. My friends always joke, every island I go to, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is amazing, this is my favourite. But I think probably the kind of remote, I've been to St Kilda.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting. St Kilda, I took my dad for his 70th.
Yeah.
And it was, you'll be the same, like, everything you're growing up with in Shetland, especially when there's like old photos and kind of talking about the way it used to be, there's always kind of pictures of St Kilda as well. Always talk about the kind of similarities with the kind of the lifestyle and things. So it was, yeah, definitely somewhere my dad really wanted to go to, and so did I. So we went for his 70th, and it was, yeah, it was amazing. It's really, really stunning place. Really special. Yeah, definitely want to kind of get you. I want to go back because like the trips themselves are fantastic, but 4 hours, you feel like you just scratched the surface. So I'd love to go back for a bit more time. So St Kilda was amazing. And I think because I was with my dad as well, I think because obviously a lot of it was kind of not strangely nostalgic, I suppose, for him, even though it's not somewhere he ever was or anything. But I think, you know, there is that kind of nostalgia of the kind of an older way of life, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's always a kind of commonality between like island communities. They've got so many similarities, whether it's a Shetland island or an island on the west coast of Scotland or at the other side of the world. I think island communities have got a real kind of connecting bond between them, probably due to like the isolation and just having your kind of boundary of the sea that kind of just defines your whole community by the sea that surrounds you.
And it's interesting because whenever I go to islands, people maybe talk and then they'll be chatting away, and then as soon as I mention I'm from Shetland, they're like, oh, okay. It's almost like, yeah, you get it, we don't need to, you know, they just kind of, it's almost like, oh, you're an islander, you'll understand. And it's the same on the ferries, they'll be like, well, it's a bit of a choppy crossing, isn't it? And I'm like, I've done the P&O ferry crossing up to Shetland and the North Link, and they're like, oh, this is fine then. You're like, yeah. Yeah. You know, there's that kind of, yeah, it is, it's quite a nice thing, like with other islanders. Like you say, there is that kind of similarity. So
yeah,
St Kilda, yeah, it was lovely. And the Isle of Rum, I really love the Isle of Rum.
Okay.
It was, yeah, it's one of the small isles just kind of near the Isle of Skye. And yeah, it's, I mean, there's not much. I found there was plenty to do, but you know, it's yeah, there's not much in the way of facilities and things like that, but it's an absolutely spectacular island. Really small community, quite remote, yeah, just gorgeous. But Colonsay as well, I kind of like the smaller islands. I don't know, I think they're really cute, and just really, I don't know, really lovely. So Colonsay is probably up there for me as well, but I could probably tell you every single island and say it's my favourite from one or another. So I'm terrible, the worst person to ask.
I really want to do more of the Western Isles, because I've only been to Skye, and I mean Skye's got a bridge now, so it's I don't know if it's lost some of that island feel.
Yeah, I think there's kind of chat about that where they feel like it's quite, I always like to try and get the ferry to Skye because it makes me feel like I'm going on the little adventure.
Yeah, because we drove to Skye, and so it didn't feel as much like we were going to an island, but if we'd have taken the ferry, then I think it would. But the people in Skye very much felt like islanders.
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, I suppose that the bridge is fair, well, I say new, but yeah, I suppose it's mad to think of it before there was a bridge there, but yeah, I think, especially if you kind of live nearer the kind of bridge in the mainland, it's probably very accessible.
Yeah.
Whereas I think you definitely do need to go to like the Western Isles and things, because that's very, yeah, it's very different. And I think just getting a ferry somewhere, it just always feels like a little bit more of an adventure. Like for me, anyways, I always love jumping on a ferry. And I think that's probably from growing up in Shetland, where we used to just jump on and off the ferries as kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Western Isles are beautiful. You'll absolutely love them. So different. Like, so all the islands are so different themselves, and then they're so different to Shetland, and then there's such similarities in other ways. Just really beautiful.
I actually just finished reading a book that's based in the one of the smaller Hebrides. I'm not sure what island it was based in, but it was the book I Am an Island by Tamsin Kalidas.
Yeah. Based in Lismore, or I think the women's day is in Lismore, just beside Oban. I've heard of the book, I haven't read it, but what was your thoughts on it? Because I've seen little excerpts of it and things.
I absolutely loved her writing. She is a beautiful writer, and it read beautifully, but I did take umbrage at some of her characterizations of islanders and that portrayal of kind of feeling like she was entering a closed community. Obviously I've never been to Lismore to kind of judge, but as an islander, I mean, we do have a strong sense of community, but we're also really welcoming if people come and make the effort to be part of the community rather than try and change the community.
100%. And I think that's really, like, that's kind of, you know, like I say, I haven't read the book, but that was kind of the feeling I got about it, with regards to kind of how it's talking about, like, island communities. And I grew up in North Mainland, so obviously there was a lot of people from all over, you know. Yeah. It wasn't just Shetlanders, and it was a very inclusive community, you know. It was, yeah. Bearing in mind that it was probably a big period of change for a lot of kind of locals who, you know, North Mainland, and then suddenly there's a big oil terminal built and there's so many people coming in. But it was an amazing community, and even now, you know, where I grew up, it's still the same. It's so inclusive and so welcoming, and yeah, there's people that have been there for years and all the rest, but I've never seen anybody personally ostracized or isolated. I think if you, like you say, come with the right attitude and you want to be there and want to be kind of part of the community, because I do not think you can be, you can't live somewhere like Shetland or in one of the communities and just want to be on your own and do that kind of, oh no, I don't need anybody's help, because it is that type of community where if somebody has something extra, they'll help you out. And it's not that you're then in their pocket, it's just the kind of the community spirit where you look after everybody and everybody looks after you. And I think as long as you have that kind of approach, then you'll always be welcomed with open arms. And as long as you, it's not to say that you need to accept traditions and everything the way it is, you know, people are open to change and all the rest, but it's just, I suppose, a right kind of attitude towards it and wanting to do it for the right reasons, not just for the sake of change.
Yeah, it was a difficult, I did find it a difficult book to read. Yeah. And I did feel sorry for the community that she was describing. Yeah. And in some parts I felt empathy for her too. But I did feel that the community itself weren't being given enough credit, maybe. It was a fantastically written book, though. It is worth reading.
I will need to have a read of it, but I'd read like a wee excerpt, and I'd read it was a kind of islander, not from the island, I don't think, but it was like an islander's response. And I kind of read their response, and I thought, I get how they feel just from reading it. I was like, I understand what they're talking about. But I went to Lismore like for an overnight kind of bikepacking trip, and I bumped into a few locals, and they were lovely. They were so lovely. Really nice. Obviously, a day trip is not the same as like moving there, but I think it depends on maybe an attitude that you bring when you move somewhere. So it's difficult to kind of comment if it's not been me directly, but I think I'd be the same. I'd be a wee bit defensive about the portrayal of islanders and the island community, because for me it's only ever been positive, and I've only seen it positively. I must have a wee read of it. I'll need to dig it out. I think
we can discuss it again when you've read it.
Definitely.
So as well as islands, you are also, I mean, you're bagging Munros all the time. I watch your Instagram stories. I'm like, my gosh, she's up another hill. But tell me about that. How many Munros are there in Scotland, and how many have you done?
In Scotland, there's 282 Munros. So that's mountains, hills over 3,000 feet, or 914.4 metres, if you want to be specific. And I'm currently on 146. So I just hit my halfway point last month.
Amazing.
I've done a conference, and so I've got less Munros to do now than I've done, which is quite an exciting thought. So absolutely love being up in the hills. It's really good. It's totally addictive, and I think I've discovered I like a list. So basically there's Munros, I can like tick them off, islands I can tick them off, quite like a lighthouse as well. So I realize it's a list thing for me, obviously, and I'm quite enjoying kind of, it's nice to tick them off, but it's not purely for the purpose of ticking them off, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I'll tell you a website that you'll really enjoy then. It's just a small website called Shetland by Numbers. I'll put a link in the show notes. And it was a local botanist called Walter Scott that lives in Shetland, and he passed away a year or two ago. But he like he did a website with all the like all the lighthouses, all the islands, all the islands in lochs, and he visited all these places and like ticked them off, and he documented it on his website, Shetland by Numbers. So
oh my god, that sounds so exciting. I'm so excited. I've got it written down, so I will definitely get on that. 100%.
Yeah, have a look. But in Shetland, like, we've not got any Munros here in Shetland. We have their smaller cousin, the Marilyn, Rennie's Hill or Rona's Hill being the highest. And so I've actually never done a Munro. So what advice would you give somebody who's kind of planning a walking holiday or planning to do a Munro or even a Marilyn? What would you, how would you prepare to go walking?
I think the best thing, I mean, Walk Highlands is a fantastic website which kind of documents walks from Munros to Marilyns, even kind of low level walks. It's kind of got them all. And I think they've recently done, they were in Shetland and kind of updated their website for lots of Shetland walks as well, which is good.
But yeah.
For me, it's kind of knowing your own limits, I think. Munros, there are a lot of kind of, you know, I hate to say the phrase, easy Munros, because there aren't really any, you know, it's not easy. It's weather dependent, conditions, your own ability. But, you know, there are maybe more straightforward Munros. So if you're looking, then I would be looking for maybe the kind of more popular ones with like paths on them, which are quite well maintained. So like Shehalion has got a good path, Ben Lomond, you know, a lot of the kind of probably Central Belt, Ben Wyvis actually up in Inverness. They're all fairly kind of well maintained with the paths and things. And it really depends on the route. If you're following the path up, a lot of them are fairly straightforward, but you know, the weather at the bottom can be, you know, beautiful, gorgeous, and then at the top it can be blowing a hoolie and absolutely freezing. So it's just checking the weather, knowing your own ability. Don't be afraid to kind of turn back, and just having the right kit with you. So comfy footwear and layers, like always carry lots of layers, because I always got told when I was going like to do my first two hills, always pack as if you're going to spend the night. So I've always took loads of stuff with me. And it's just always best, worst case scenario, you'll be warm, you'll be, you know, you'll have food and water with you. So just start small, I think, and then build up to it.
Have you ever had any kind of scary experiences in the hills?
Yeah, I've had a few, probably early days when I started doing Munros. It was November, kind of just not really aware of like the kind of reduction in daylight hours, I suppose. Set off quite late, was probably a bit ambitious with the walk we were doing. I was kind of very early days of, I was walking with somebody and I was like, oh, they know where we're going, so I don't really need to be prepared. And that was a lesson learned from that day, because we took a wrong route off. It was getting dark. We'd done one Munro of the two and we thought, oh, we'll just head down. Thought we were descending down the correct route, and we weren't. And by the time we realised, it was too kind of dark and too much effort to go back up.
Yeah.
Because we were maybe a bit disorientated. So it was, it was pretty tough. It was dark. My shoelaces snapped. I didn't have a head torch. So I was using like the phone on my iPhone. It was a proper kind of, we're either going to have to, you know, there's that moment of, we're going to have to bed down and wait till daylight, or we're going to have to phone mountain rescue. And then I think you kind of get a moment of like, right, pull it together, need to get out here. And it was pretty arduous, and it was quite a horrible feeling. But I think in saying that, it's very easy to be like sitting here now and go, oh, be prepared and take this and take that. But, you know, luckily we got down safe. We were fine, just a bit, you know, a bit of a lesson learned and stuff. But it kind of teaches you. I've never been in that situation again, because I always have spare laces. I always have a head torch. I always know where I'm going now. I'm aware of the time, the daylight. You kind of need to learn these things, but it was horrible. I've still not done the second Munro on the walk, because I'm quite confident going up the hills myself, but for some reason, and it's the Ballyhoolish Horseshoe if anybody knows it, for some reason, I cannot bring myself to go up there on my own again, in case. I mean, I know how to read a map, I'm totally fine, but I'm waiting for somebody to come with me on that one. I don't know
what
my nemesis is.
Just the memory.
Yeah, because you could see Ballyhoolish Village, you could see the lights on, and we were so high up in this mountain, it was pitch black and all you could see was the street lights, and it was like knowing that everybody was so close by, but you couldn't get there. Oh, it was horrible, really horrible.
Yeah. And you've just actually completed your mountain leader training. Do you think that that's something like that experience is something that inspired you to do mountain leader? And can you just tell us what the training is and what it involves?
Yeah, the mountain leader training, so it's with the hope of going on to do my mountain leader qualification, which would allow me to take people and guide people up Munros and hills and things, and it allows me to do it in a kind of a professional capacity, where I could have insurances and things like that. So for me, I think for me there was two reasons I wanted to do it. One was to kind of consolidate my own knowledge and kind of get the skills that I needed. So it would cover, the mountain leader training covers like navigation, equipment, group management, and it covers like 2 day or a 2 day expedition. So it's just again about carrying the right kit with you for camping overnight, etc. And for me, I put it off. Like I'd signed up for it like years ago. And I just never thought I had I was like, oh no, I don't have enough experience. I'm going to be the slowest person. All the usual kind of talking yourself out of things. And I went on the course and I thought, oh, I'm actually, there's still definitely things I need to know and need to kind of brush up on. And you do learn skills like basic kind of rope work, if you end up in a kind of sticky situation. But yeah, I was quite pleased that I was like, oh, okay, I kind of know some of this and I'm okay with this. And but even now in saying that, at the time I probably felt really confident, and now because it's been a few like what maybe a month or two, I'm like, oh, am I okay to go ahead and do the qualification? Do I know enough? Yeah, it was really good. It was really interesting, and yeah, I was not the weakest link. I wasn't the slowest. I wasn't, but yeah, just have this ability to kind of talk ourselves out of things, I think.
Know,
But
it's funny because I mean you've done so many things that you're never ever going to be the slowest or the least fit, and we'll speak about some of the other things you've done in a moment. But I wanted to kind of find out, with a mountain leader training and qualification, do you plan on taking tours or people into the hills? Is it something that you're kind of toying with at the moment, or is it still a secret?
no, not a secret at all. Yeah, I think it is something I would like to do. I could take people up hills now, no problem, but I wouldn't feel right. I think it's good to have, the proper qualifications and things. I obviously go with friends and that, but I do get, people messaging asking if I would, if I would do a hill, or, asking to kind of guide people. But I just wouldn't feel until I've got the proper qualifications and that kind of, confidence, I suppose, by having the qualification to do it. And I just don't feel it would be appropriate because it's, there's loads of people that do mountain leading, and I don't think it would be appropriate for me to do it without having the qualifications. But I would like to. I think for me, like every time I'm up a hill, I know how lucky I am. I am genuinely so lucky to be up there to see these views, to be fit enough and able enough to do all these things. And yeah, I just really like the thought of maybe introducing other people, because I was very lucky that somebody kind of took me hill walking for the first time and kind of was there to like hold my hand and tell me all the right stuff. A lot of people don't have that, I suppose. And for me, oh yeah, go and do a Munro. They might not be able to get there. They might not know the right kit, all these kind of things. And I just think it'd be so nice to be able to kind of be that person for somebody else and like, show them the ropes the first time, and then that would maybe give them the confidence. And yeah, I think it'd be really good. It would be nice. But I think I still have the fear that I'd be like, oh my God, imagine if the weather was awful, it would be all my fault. But yeah.
But I sometimes used to feel like that, if I was doing a tour and it was terrible weather. But actually, the people who are coming here, or people who were planning to go walking in the mountains or whatever, I mean, they're coming and they're well aware what they're in for. And actually, some of the tours that I've done on the worst days are the ones that people have enjoyed the most. And I think it's because they're experiencing something that is not familiar to where they come from.
Yeah, totally. I think that is the case. And I think I probably just would worry so much and be like, oh my goodness. But I think that would probably fade, like you say. I think initially you just feel like everything's got to be perfect. But I just think just give somebody that kind of step up to kind of show them how accessible the mountains and the outdoors can be would be really nice. So yeah, hopefully next year I'll get my qualification done, and that would be lovely to kind of take people and, you know, and hopefully I can return the favour and take you up a wee Munro.
Oh, I would definitely, yeah, I'd love to. I'll definitely, when I'm on the mainland, when we're allowed to travel again, then
I'll
definitely do it.
With you, we'll be fine.
Just a small one, mind.
Yeah, no.
But I think as well, for, like, there's definitely a need for it, because, like, for people who are maybe coming to Scotland from abroad, the kind of access rules are so different here. We've got the right to roam, and I think people are just really unsure, because it's maybe something that's not familiar to where they're coming from. So to have a guide and have somebody say, you're okay, we can go on the land here, we're not going to get shouted at or shot or whatever, I think there is a need for it, and people would certainly be interested in joining, and just having somebody, as you said, that knows where they're going, knows what they're doing, and can read the weather and the light and everything. I would definitely come.
Oh, good. Well, hopefully next year I'll get qualified, and then, yeah, it'd be really nice. It'd be nice to say, it sounds bizarre to say mountain leader. I still think, oh, I'm still in the hills. It sounds really bizarre, but yeah, that would be really nice. So hopefully next year get qualified and then get some people up hills. So that would be good.
Another thing that I really like about what you put on your Instagram, and which I'll feed into the mountain leader and everything, is just the way that you try and educate people about how to kind of act responsibly when they're outdoors, and I think that's so important. And like recently here in Shetland, I've spoken to landowners who have been unhappy with how some people have been moving around the land, and kind of just a disregard for the landscape. And it's not through deliberately trying to be horrible or disrespectful, it's just a lack of education. So I think that what you do in trying to educate people is really, really good, because we all need to be a bit more responsible.
I think it is, like you say, and I kind of done that Spirit of Wild Camping with the Cairngorms, and yeah, that was about, and I was kind of saying that, it was like, you know, we didn't think people were trying to be bad or, you know, awful. It was just a lack of knowledge, maybe a lack of awareness. And it's great, you know, I can come at it with a few years experience now and say, right, well, here's what you should be doing, but I didn't know all of these things either. You know, it's people have educated me and shown me the right way to do things, because I think everybody, you know, like the banana peel thing, I think everybody thinks, oh, but it's biodegradable, you know, any kind of food, they just, you know, it's not an issue. But in busy places, you don't want to see food lying around, you don't want to see things sitting, you know, all these kind of things. And I think it's nice to pass on the knowledge, as opposed to like preach and tell people off. It's better to kind of educate and encourage people to look after, because people are going somewhere because it's a gorgeous place. So it's just being mindful that you went there because it's so untouched and lovely. You want it to be exactly the same for the next person. And I think it's just making people think about that. I try not to come across as preachy. It's just how I would want to see somewhere. And that's how I try and pass it on to other people, is how they would want to find somewhere. So
what kind of things would you say we should be doing and kind of shouldn't be doing when we're out in the outdoors?
I think it's just being really respectful. So being aware, not even just if you're doing like mountains and things, but in general, when you're traveling to places, I know it is all a bit different with COVID at the minute, but in general kind of situations, I would always say, like, if you're going somewhere, try and invest in the local community, and don't be somebody that just turns up, you know, and disappears again. Try and invest, like, you're there, you're using facilities and whatnot. So try and maybe, I don't know, use a local petrol station, or buy some food from the shop, or go to one of the local cafes. I always think it's really important to kind of give back to wherever you're visiting, and don't just cruise through and, you know, use the roads, tear up the roads and all the rest, but then don't actually give anything back. Be mindful, because as much as we do have right to roam, it's still somebody's land a lot of times, you know, especially probably more low level, you know, there's livestock and all these things. Just being respectful, you know, that's somebody's livelihood at the end of the day. And a lot of hills, they do go through like estates or properties at the start. Most of them are very good at having signs and directing you in the right direction. Just try and stick with that and be mindful. You know, you don't want to walk past somebody's living room window, do you know, if you
no,
somebody peering in. So it's just trying to be respectful, and obviously, you know, any rubbish and stuff, if you've carried something up a hill, you can take the empty wrappers back down. I think that's just so simple.
And that does, it goes for banana skins too, because that, what you referred to earlier, some people would say that, oh, that it degrades and it's not a problem, but actually if you're on a busy mountain and everybody leaves a banana skin, I mean, they do take years to degrade, so if everybody is leaving a banana skin, we're going to have a mountain that's yellow like a banana skin.
Yeah, exactly. And it's such a kind of basic, you think, you know, you can just take a little sandwich bag with you or something and just wrap up and take it home. And parking as well, I think, is a big one that there's a lot of issues with, so just being mindful, like, if you think it's obstructing somebody, you think you shouldn't be parked there, you probably shouldn't be parked there. There's plenty of places to go. I know people drive a long distance to go places, but yeah, you need to be respectful of people that live in that community or live in the area. Nobody wants to upset people and annoy people. And I know that everyone's frustrated with lockdowns and tiers and things, but you do still have to be mindful of other people. So it's just, it is just respectful, because there is enough space for everybody.
Yeah.
Be clever about it, I suppose.
Yeah. Good advice. Thank you.
I know, a bit creepy there, I think, hopefully.
No, not at all. It's something that I've spoken about in a podcast before, and I've written about it on the blog. It's something that I feel quite strongly about. It's just education and being responsible. But it's not just Munros that you do. I look at you and I think you're just like some sort of superwoman. You've done triathlons, you've done the Ironman, and last year you were trekking in Nepal. Yeah. Can you just tell us about some of those adventures?
Do you know, it sounds really weird, but see, when I kind of say them, it seems bizarre that I've done them, because I know it's very easy to say, you know, like, oh, I've done so many Munros, I've done this, I've done that, but I'm not that person. Like, I'm really not. I've never described myself as like a fit or athletic person or anything at all. Like, it's all just gradually kind of grown and grown, I suppose. But yeah, the triathlon, I mean, I don't know what I was thinking. I'd always kind of fancied doing a triathlon, but I couldn't swim, so that kind of...
Yeah, you had to learn to swim, didn't you?
Do you know, I remember being in... I had such a kind of fear of the water. I don't know why, but I remember being in the Bray swimming pool, and I can't remember the woman's name that was taking us for lessons, but I must have been like 4 or 5. And they kind of hold you and try and teach you how to like float and swim. And I remember screaming, honestly, like screaming my head off, do not let go of me. I just thought I was going to sink.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of always stuck with me. And yeah, so they kind of, which is quite embarrassing being a Shetlander and then saying you can't really swim and you're like a bit scared of the water. You're like, oh,
you would be so surprised at how many fishermen can't swim.
No, but do you not think it's mad, considering how good, like, we do have good leisure facilities, like everywhere has a swimming pool. I don't know, like, I was happy in the water but couldn't really swim as such. I didn't like my face being in the water, but
yeah
I always kind of fancied a triathlon. And then my friend was kind of like, yeah, we're thinking, let's do this. And we signed up in October, and it was kind of, I don't drink or anything, but I can only explain it as we kind of registered for it like midnight the night before, and then the next morning kind of like waking up and going, what did I do last night? Like, oh my god, did we actually sign up for that? Because another friend was saying, oh my goodness, it's going to sell out, you need to sign up. So there was no real time for deliberation. It was like, right, we'll just book it and deal with the consequences. But yeah, that was tough. Like, it was tough training for it. I felt like it took over my life a wee bit. But yeah, the feeling of like completing it, so it was like a half Ironman, so 70.3 miles all in.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was definitely, I mean, it was scary putting it on my social media, because I kind of didn't mention it for a long time. I don't think I kind of actually said I was doing it until like March, and I was doing the event in May. And I think I had such a fear of like either not doing it or failing, or, you know. And then I kind of realized, you know what, it's not the worst thing in the world if I don't do this. And it was kind of like putting it on my social media was kind of like that little boost of, well, you put it out there now, you really need to put in the effort. So.
But you did do it.
Yeah, it was honestly an amazing feeling, absolutely amazing. I remember just coming out from the swim and I just kind of just wanted to burst into tears. I couldn't believe I'd just done it. I was so like proud of myself, and that was like the biggest worry for me. I kept worrying I'd miss the cutoff and I wouldn't get to do the rest of the triathlon. And it's not that I wasn't bothered about what else was coming, but the biggest hurdle for me was getting through the swim. And I don't think I'd really thought past that. So then I was like, oh, I've done that now. So right, I need to go and cycle for like, you know, so many miles, 56 miles. And it was hard going, but that getting through that swim was just incredible. And I think once I got through that, I kind of thought, God, I might be able to do this now. You know,
yeah,
it'd be possible. It was fantastic, an amazing event. And when we signed up, people were like, oh, that's quite a hilly cycle, that's quite a tough route. And we were like, what? we maybe should have researched. So there's like flatter triathlons you can do, but we chose a very hilly cycle. But it was good, and do you know what, it was an amazing experience, such an amazing event. Really glad I'd done it. It was good.
I just totally in awe, because I could never do it. I know I couldn't do it.
But if you'd asked me, like, I'd have said, oh my goodness, no, like, I could not do that. And then, and it's, you'll look at some of the things you've done and you think, oh, that would never happen. And then as soon as you've done it, you're like, oh, that's very achievable. So that's totally, like, anybody I reckon could do a 70.2 could.
I'll take your word for it. Another kind of challenge that you did that I was totally in awe was when you went to Nepal, and that really looked incredibly difficult.
Oh, that was, like, I thought the Ironman Mallorca was tough, but my goodness, like, Nepal was a challenge. And I think I always try to put, you know, in anything I do, I don't just put on the positive, oh my god, this is so easy, I'm so great. It was kind of like, this is awful, I'm really struggling. It was really difficult. And I think the altitude is, I suppose it's probably more psychological, I think, because I was going into that off the back of the triathlon, so I was fairly, you know, fairly fit at the time.
Yeah.
And to then be struggling to kind of walk a slight incline and feeling really exhausted, it's really difficult, because you're sitting thinking, I know I'm fitter than this, so why am I so out of breath? And it was really tough.
What altitude were you at?
So Island Peak is 6,189 metres. So bear in mind, like, what's Ben Nevis, 1,411 metres?
Yeah.
So a bit of a difference. It was totally, I think I kind of went from, there was no middle ground, you know, I'd never been anywhere with any kind of altitude, and then went straight to Everest Base Camp, which in itself is difficult, and then I'll go and climb a mountain as well. So that was it was really tough. Like, the acclimatization days were difficult, because you were hiking up to a point and then coming back down, but getting up to the point, which, if you were in Scotland, it would be like, it would take you like no time at all to kind of nip up this hill.
Yeah.
But the altitude was exhausting. I mean, I was like, so many times, I mean, I always got to the summit of any acclimatization day we were doing, and it wasn't until afterwards the guide were like, a lot of people don't make those because they just, you know, they really struggle. And I was like, well, you might have told me. I kind of thought, oh, if I don't make this, like, acclimatization day, then I'm not going to make, you know, the kind of Island Peak summit. So, good. I'm kind of glad, because it, you know, it did keep you pushing on and stuff, but it was, you know, you're so cold, the food's very different. I mean, the food's lovely, but it's very samey, and once you're there for like 3 weeks, it's a bit repetitive.
I was gonna say, how long were you there?
It was a long time. I think it was just under 3 weeks of actual trekking and doing Island Peak. You're kind of cold, like, all the accommodation, there's no heating in any of it, and there's like maybe heating in like the kind of the food area, like kind of wood burners, but with different fuel. So, but the rooms don't have any heating, so you're literally in down jackets with hot water bottles, and it's just being cold and kind of, I mean, you do get used to it, but it was definitely, definitely difficult. And by the end of it, you are, you're ready for like kind of home comforts. But
yeah,
it's so interesting. As soon as you've kind of done the ascent and you're coming back down, you're practically skipping, even though you're at altitude, because you feel like, oh, well, I've done it. I've been, you know, you've been at 6,189.
Yeah.
Down, you feel great. You're like, and it only takes like 2 or 3 days to get back, when it takes you about 2 weeks to get there, which is obviously all due to slowly climbing through altitude and stuff. But it was difficult. But I did take my Shetland flag with me, though.
I saw that.
Yeah.
You'll have to send me the picture of that so I can share it.
Oh, honestly, I love it. Well, I kind of done a thing on my, in fact, the Radio Shetland spoke to me about it, because I was wondering if it was the highest the Shetland flag had been.
Yeah.
So they haven't said that it's been any higher. I mean, there must have been people that have had it higher. I don't know, but
I don't know.
It was quite a nice thing because I was like, I had an Everest base camp, and then I was like, I need to take this up here, and I'm so proud of that picture. I love it. Like,
yeah,
I love it.
Was there any moment when you were doing it that you thought, I'm gonna give up, I can't do it?
Probably we were at Dun Everest base camp, and then I think we were staying, we hiked to like the kind of the last night's accommodation before we went to Island Peak base camp. So you don't really have a phone signal, but I got like Wi-Fi, I got a Wi-Fi card there, and at Chukung, I think it was, and I was messaging my sisters just saying, that's me at the kind of last night's stay. I'm going to base camp tomorrow, and then the day after, Island Peak, hopefully. And I remember messaging, it still makes me emotional. I just remember messaging them saying, don't be disappointed if I don't make it. You know, but because you were getting all the climbing gear sorted. So mm-hmm. It kind of, you could see Island Peak and you're like, oh my goodness, like, you know, it was a big undertaking. And yeah. I just remember messaging them saying, don't be disappointed. And, you know, it's really difficult, blah, blah, blah. And they messaged back and they were like, do not be daft, we would never be disappointed, like, you know, but we wouldn't be disappointed, but on the other hand, we know how stubborn you are, so we have no doubt that you will do this.
Yeah.
But never feel like we would ever be disappointed. What you've done is amazing so far, and honestly, like, their messages were just so encouraging and so lovely, because you don't have the ability to speak to somebody every day, and the time difference as well.
And you were doing it on, your own as well, weren't you?
It was like a group, so like a kind of, like a package kind of thing where you book and then there's other people there,
yeah.
So you don't have that kind of support network, I suppose.
Yeah.
And those messages, they meant the world. And, you know, I didn't have any contact with them for like when I was at base camp or the day off. It wasn't until I came back to Chukung, and because I'd done a wee video message to them when I was on the summit, just thanking them for their messages, because they really did mean the world. And I think that for me was probably where I was just kind of setting the kind of the expectations of my sisters that, look, this is really difficult, I might not do this. And I think their messages, though, definitely, you know, I just like that, we know how stubborn you are, you will be fine.
It drove really you to the top.
Yeah, uh-huh. So it was really lovely, it was really nice to get them. But yeah, it was, yeah, definitely difficult. But I think it was interesting, on the day of Island Peak, I actually found that probably, I don't mean easy as an effort, but as in, I'd really struggled with the altitude in other days, but I think because I was there to do Island Peak and it was doing a hill, and it was like, I thought, yeah, I'm meant to be tired because I'm doing a hill, so it felt okay.
Yeah.
I think when you're kind of doing slight ascents and you're struggling, it just psychologically really kind of got in my head a bit. But yeah, it was definitely one of the toughest things, and I've got like my video at the top, and I was like in tears, and you know, I'm really, it's really nice to have the video clips when I was struggling or when I was upset, because it's very easy to look back on things and like you look back in an old relationship and look at all the good memories and all the nice times. So it's nice to have the videos of
how
difficult it was and how tough it was, and remember like how I felt at the time, because watching it back you're like, oh god, I was really struggling, you know.
Yeah. So, and I think really encouraging for other people to see as well, because like, you didn't just share all the highlights and here's me at the top and I've done it and it was amazing, but you actually like came on and you said, I'm really struggling, I can't breathe, it's really difficult, it's really cold, and this is hard. And so it was really nice just to kind of follow the journey and actually see what it was really like inside of a kind of a glossed over version.
Yeah, and do you know what? That was one of the nicest things. I think it was the same with my Ironman training, because I would put on about my runs and how I didn't want to go and how awful I was after it. And people found it really, I really loved the messages I got, because so many people were like, this has really encouraged me to go for a run, because I don't want to go for a run, because everybody I see on social media just looks amazing and they look so effortless. And it's nice to see that you don't look effortless.
Yeah.
That you are struggling and you don't want to get off the sofa. And I thought that was really nice. And it was the same with the you know, the messages I got from like Nepal and stuff, people, supportive messages, and you know, that they appreciated seeing the kind of the whole thing, as opposed to, like you say, the kind of sugar-coated, this is amazing, this is easy. And I think that's what I've always tried to do, is keep it genuine and show the realities of it.
Yeah.
Because that's how it really is for me. You know, I'm not a super fit athletic person. I struggle just as much as everybody. So it's nice to kind of share all aspects of it, I suppose. Make it realistic, make it,
yeah,
you know.
absolutely. And what does the future for you look like? What would you like to kind of, where would you like to see yourself in the next few years? Do you have any big plans or?
No big plans, no, nothing at all. I think obviously at the minute everything's just coronavirus, isn't it?
But yeah, or not, yeah, nobody can plan anything.
And even aside, like, I don't think I've really got any kind of, you know, ideally I'd love to be outdoors 24/7, you know, that would be the absolute goal. In fact, in fairness, like, in plans wise, I don't have anything, but I've got like the Cape Wrath Ultra coming up next year, so that's like my next big challenge.
Okay.
But that's like running from Fort William up to Cape Wrath over 8 days.
Oof.
4 kilometres over 8 days.
How far?
400 kilometres. Ridiculous. But the problem was that it was the kind of company that runs Cape Wrath Ultra got in touch and asked me to do it. And their email, I just came back from Nepal, and their email to me was, "We know you're not really a runner." They'd obviously seen my Ironman training. And "We know you're not really a runner, but you're always up for an adventure. Do you fancy this?" And I just thought, they get me. Like, they totally understand. So
yeah,
doing that next year. But after that, like, hope to do my mountain leader training. I'd quite like to do some kind of water safety training, I think, just for like paddleboarding and swimming.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm out with people, that would be quite good. But no real massive plans, just kind of ticking off my Munros, business amounts, getting back home because it's been ages. And yeah, nothing too exciting. I should probably have some bigger plans, but
I think those are pretty good.
Yeah, well, hopefully. So yeah, that's actually it. No big massive agenda, but just
get your Munros and your islands ticked off your checklist.
Exactly, and get onto that Shetland by numbers. That's the next one.
Yeah, you could do your own Scotland by numbers.
No, I could actually. Oh, God.
There you go. There's your 5-year plan.
For that, Laurie, cheers.
I also wanted to ask you, because it's something that really interests me, is that, and we've kind of touched on it speaking about Tamsin's book, I Am an Island, but that kind of sense of belonging that ties us to a place. Do you feel that in relation to Shetland, and is it something that you feel strongly, or what do you kind of think about that sense of belonging?
It's such an interesting thing, because I always talk about it quite a lot with Scotland and with Shetland. I think being a Shetlander massively defines me. I think it's made me who I am. I think, you know, I love my surname because it's very, you know, it's very clear that it's a Shetland surname. I just think it defines everything about me. And I think I've always said, like, I can look at views in Nepal and they are spectacular, but there's something about being in Shetland and looking at a view at home that you just have that sense of belonging where you're like, this is my home. Like, you know, the view is, you know, totally different, but you're just that kind of sense that it's yours, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I know it sounds a bit kind of possessive, but I don't know. It's like a really strong link. And I don't know if it's because being an islander, but community is such a big thing. I don't know. I think there's maybe obviously the ties with nostalgia, and a lot of your memories are all kind of based around Shetland, and it's shaped who I am. I don't know. It's an interesting thing, because I know you were kind of talking about it before with the kind of sense of belonging, and I know there's a lot of people that can move places and feel like they really belong there and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think, for me, it's probably just so many things are wrapped up in Shetland that no matter where I am in the world, when I go, it's different. I feel like I'm almost like not a different person here, but whenever I go home, people just get it. They just get, you know, you're a Shetlander, and they just, you know, people, and they know you, and everybody. I can't really sum it up very articulately, but
it's a difficult one, but it's definitely something that, something that we feel, I think, and it's really deep rooted.
100%. That's why, like, you know, going to like Nepal and stuff and taking my Shetland flag, you know, that's massively important to me. I was like, I had my Shetland flag, you know. It's very important that people know where I'm from and that I'm a Shetlander, because I think immediately by saying I'm a Shetlander, it tells you a lot about me. I think it's really important for me.
And I find when people come to both like Scotland and Shetland on holiday, if they're maybe coming from the state where their ancestors had left a few generations ago from Scotland or from Shetland, I often find that they get quite emotional when they're here because they feel that really strong sense that they belong.
Yeah, 100%. And I think there's obviously that kind of sadness to that as well, the fact that they've left and, you know, that kind of coming back, I suppose. It must be a lovely feeling. I can't imagine what that must be like. Because, you know, we've done our family tree and it's like my dad's side is all Shetland. And I love that. I love that kind of the roots are there and everything. And
yeah,
it is a lovely feeling. And I love that people can get that from, you know, like you say, coming back and kind of tracing their roots. And
yeah,
it just, I don't know, it's just an amazing, amazing feeling. And I think most, well, I was going to say Islanders, but maybe like Scottish people and Islanders, they just have a really strong sense of identity, I think. And I think it's really rooted in where you're from and being really proud of your country and things. And I think that's a really good thing. I think it's, you know, whenever I've worked with people, maybe from like abroad or America, they've always said that we have this unique kind of patriotism, I suppose, or this, you know, sense of belonging. And a lot of people say, oh, we don't really have that. And I was like, oh, it massively defines me, massively.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really important. I'm glad I'm from Shetland. Wouldn't want to have been born anywhere else in the world. And I was born in Shetland, so I know there's obviously a lot of people born in Aberdeen. In the Gilbert Bay.
Yeah, me too.
Yay!
And listen, for visitors who are coming to Shetland, whenever that may be, what would your top three suggestions be?
Top three, probably Noss. I really love Noss. I think it's absolutely spectacular. And I got to see a basking shark in the kind of bay as well, which was amazing. But I just think going to Noss, it kind of looks like one thing. Do you know when you come from Brest, it looks like one thing, and then you get up into the cliffs and you are like blown away. I think it's incredible.
So would you do the boat trip into Noss and walk the island, or would you take a boat trip around the island?
I haven't done the boat trip around the island.
Oh, it's amazing too.
I'd imagine like being at the foot of those cliffs would be absolutely spectacular. What's the name of it? It's like there's, obviously, is that a marlin as well? I think it is, isn't it?
The Nupa Noss. I'm actually not sure. It is, what height is the Nupa Noss? 170 metres, I think, the Nupa Noss.
51 metres. And then, yeah, I think it's a marlin, but it's, I mean, the Nupa Noss is spectacular. So I need to do the boat trip. So I can't compare the two, but I just know when you walk on from like the wee boat crossing, it looks like a fairly kind of flattish island from that kind of side. And then you obviously walk around to the Nup, and it's, especially when the gannets are there, and it's just amazing. Like,
It's a spectacular sea cliff.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it. So there would be one, probably Rona's Hill. You have to go to the highest point. I'd say that's a must. And we'd always kind of look, we could kind of see it from where we stayed, and it would be like, oh, there's snow on Rona's Hill. I mean, it would literally be a dust in the snow, but there's a bit of snow on Rona's Hill. But I'd say Rona's Hill because it's lovely and the views, like, yeah, it's gorgeous. You get stunning views on a good day. And it's not, you know, I've not done the walk around down to the beach and stuff because I've heard that's really gorgeous.
The Lang Eyre, yeah, it's amazing.
I need to go down there, but yeah, Rona's Hill, I think you need to go to the highest point and it's the best viewpoint.
And it's not a huge walk, really, because you can park at the top of Colliford Hill and then just nip across.
Exactly. I think if you were driving in, they'd be thinking, oh, that's a big hill, and then you're like, oh no, I've actually driven halfway up it. It's really nice. To whittle it down to three, Muckleflugga, because let's be honest, it's incredible.
Most northerly point.
Yes, and it's just spectacular, you know, just to see it and to see you've been there, I think is pretty special. I was lucky enough to get like a boat trip around Muckleflugga.
Okay.
And it was actually on my birthday, which was amazing. And that was stunning. But even to get out to the viewpoint at Hermanness and Unst and stuff,
that's a brilliant place for seabirds, because in the summer you can basically touch the puffins. They're just everywhere.
So incredible. I think as well, like, you need to, people always laugh at like the kind of interest I think Shetlanders have in birds and stuff, because they're so synonymous with the seasons and things though as well.
Yeah, you know? They are.
it's just like, oh, there's Terex, right, that's summer. And I don't know, I just think it's really nice. So anywhere that there's all these kind of all the birds and things is stunning. But I mean, I'd say that's three, but then there's also like, I only like it because of the name of it. It's a little hill across from Bow, just at Ulnafirth, called Snuggy. I just like the name. So we done it with my cousins and I was like, fuck you, little hill, and the view is lovely. So
I mean, that's it. You can go to all the kind of top beauty spots like Noss and Harmoness, and but also just any of the hills, or you'll find a fantastic view and just that peace and quiet.
Exactly, and that's the thing, they're never really going to be busy. Do you know, it's, you know, you can kind of go up and down these places and not really bump into other people. There's so many. There's also I always say it wrong. I always think Ooya up in that's gorgeous. Absolutely spectacular. But obviously a bit of a walk. I think they had some issues, did they not, maybe with people kind of accessing
there's a bit of a private track that goes in, and they had problems with people taking vehicles out, and because it's a private track, then they need to maintain it, and cars were getting stuck. So definitely if you're going to places like Ooya, then you should ideally check with the landowner that it's okay to go in, because they might be working with sheep or whatever. But certainly don't take your vehicle in with you, just do the walk.
No, it's lovely. It's absolutely stunning. So worth the walk, because it's just, you're going over the fields and stuff, and then just this little, it's like a little slice of heaven. It's gorgeous.
That's a good way of describing it.
Yeah, because it's just so unexpected. I think that's a lot of Shetland, is kind of, maybe if you're like driving through, like from like the halfway house to Lerwick, you kind of think, well, maybe not so much now, but you'd be like, oh, it's quite barren and stuff. And then you kind of get to the sea cliffs and you think, oh, wow, you know, didn't expect this. But although it's a shame, because the halfway house view will be a bit different next time, I suppose.
Yeah, at the moment they're building the windmills.
Yeah, it makes me so sad.
I know, it is really sad, because so it's a wind farm that's 103 turbines that's going in the kind of central mainland, and there's a lot of public opposition. And yeah, the views there, it was always like you described it as barren. And I mean, it felt in some ways like an empty landscape, just these rolling hills and heather moorland. But far from being an empty landscape, it's a really important breeding area for birds. And it's a blanket peat bog, so that's really important for storing and locking in carbon. And just a really delicate ecosystem.
Yeah, it's such a shame, because that's like, for us, obviously come from North Mainland to Lerwick for like the monthly shop, you know, that's like the road. You'd always like, oh, we're at the halfway house, we're nearly like at Lerwick, you know, and you had your kind of markers, and that area, I just always, you know, there's parts like in Scotland when you go and it's like big kind of moory kind of bog and peat, and I'll always like, oh, that's like Shetland. And whenever I'm thinking of Shetland, I'm thinking of that, you know, that that piece of land. And it's such a shame that it's going to be different now, you know. Especially that beautiful little halfway house, you know.
Yeah, and I think that the beauty of that area is that it is so untouched, and you can be there, and other than the road and that the one house, the halfway house, there's really no evidence of humans around. It's just, you do feel like you're in another world. It is a shame.
I know, I don't like, you know, there's things, obviously, it's not that people don't want change, but it needs to be within keeping. And yeah, that's just a bit of a shame, but.
Yeah. Oh, and that's the spot that you're furthest away from the sea in Shetland. So you're 3 miles away.
Really? Is that exact sea? I never knew that. Because I always thought halfway house, I'd be like the halfway house. I don't know, it's just, I suppose everybody knows, like, that's your kind of marker on your way into Lerwick, really.
Yeah, it's as far from the sea as you'll ever be.
Oh, I didn't know that. There we go.
Yeah, fun fact for the day.
Yeah, hopefully I'll get up next year and get home and see everything and see everybody again.
Yeah, well, listen, thank you very much for coming on today, and sorry to keep you talking for so long.
Yeah, I'm a chatterbox, sorry. But no, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been brilliant to have you. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. thank you for listening. This podcast can only be made possible by my supporters on Patreon, so a huge thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to support me in bringing you more of these shows, you can sign up and become a patron. You will find details about how to sign up in the show notes below, or at www.patreon.com and just search Shetland with Laurie. And remember, you can find more on Instagram and give me a follow at Shetland with Laurie. So thank you once again for listening, and we will see you here next time. And in the meantime, safe and happy travels.